So first of all, one announcement. Next Saturday, I will be leading the Sociology Department's annual Sociocultural Bike Ride of Madison, which I do every year. This is the 15th annual Sociocultural Bike Ride. It starts at 10 o'clock in the morning in the parking lot behind Budget Bicycle, behind their new bike store. They have several bike stores. I think it's 1215 Regent Street. And you can rent a bike there if you don't have one. If you want to rent a bike, you should get there at 9:30 just to get all the paperwork done, because we'll leave pretty promptly right at 10. The bike tour has three loops. The first loop, which goes through the center of town and the isthmus and stops at various places. The first loop is quite leisurely. You know, it's filled with people who aren't regular bikers. I show you various interesting sites that not everybody knows about, and particularly I point out some of the best restaurants in town for when you have affluent relatives who might come to visit and who just say, well, where should we go for dinner? I want to give you a treat, and you'll have some good answers to the question. but also other interesting things, and it's a chance to kind of explore the city in a leisurely way. So the first loop ends up at Old Brick Gardens, which is a lovely botanical garden in town where we have lunch, so you should bring a sandwich with you. Then we head back into town, and the first loop ends. That's about 10 miles altogether, the first loop. And the first loop is the slowest, takes a couple of hours, 2.5, 3 hours, I suppose. Then we go through the Arboretum and out the Southwest Bike Path and sort of end outside of town. And at that point, people can head back into town. Or they can come with me to Apple Garden, which is a fantastic orchard that's south of Madison, where I will be carrying my big panier, two of them, so I can bring back into town with me about 40 pounds worth of apples. It's prime season now. You can either pick your own or get them at their store. So we'll stop at Apple Garden and then come back. So the whole thing, usually there's only two or three people who are wanting to do that last bit, but I encourage any of you to do so. The entire thing, it starts at 10. We're back in town by 4:30 or 5 if you do the whole ride. So that's at 10 o'clock on Saturday. And you're all welcome, and you can bring friends and comrades, anybody. You can spread the word. This is an open event, not just for some inner circle in sociology. All right. Does anybody else have announcements? I know sometimes people want to announce events or political rallies, whatever. And then the next order of business is, does anyone have follow-up questions from last week? Any loose ends or issues which have occurred to you since the talk lecture? Yeah.
I kind of have a big question, so if it's too big, we can all leave it for prior to class. So from the readings last week, there's several things of traditional Marxism that are deemed to be either incorrect or insufficient in explaining certain things. And so I was wondering if you could summarize some of these traditional arguments and why they're thought to be incorrect. I saw three big ones, the labor theory of value, doubt of the way that the crisis of overproduction is produced, and then the third one, the teleological nature of the Marxist argument.
So these are things which we'll be dealing with throughout the semester, sort of around each of the main themes. I will be drawing attention to where I think the real strengths, the robust core of the tradition lie, and where the shakier bits are. So let me just hit the key issues. The second of the third that you mentioned, crises of overproduction, I wouldn't put that in the same category. I mean, that is, there are times when there is crisis of overproduction. It's one of the ways that crisis conditions get generated. It's just not a universal mechanism. It's a particular mechanism. And Marx certainly had an acute way of thinking about it, and I don't know if he was the first person to suggest that that was a inherent crisis tendency. I like to think of capitalism as having many crisis tendencies, many ways in which the system can break down. And it's historically somewhat contingent, and there may be some historical evolution, that is, some kinds of crisis mechanisms may be more characteristic of a capitalism in formation and not a mature capitalism. There's lots of interesting stuff around that. But that I would just consider one of the interesting dimensions and arguments within the Marxist tradition that still has play. I don't think of it as a robust core. It's, you can feel that it's not valid and still be fully engaged in the tradition. I do think the teleological aspect of Marxism, that is the view that Marxism has from the start, that we have now an accurate theory of the future and of the destination, you know, sort of the destiny of capitalism is known before it happens, and known in a rich way, you know, not in the trivial way. There's a trivial version which says nothing lasts forever, so capitalism can't last forever. Duh. I mean, that's not an interesting thesis. Marxism had a very specific way of saying capitalism destroys its own conditions of existence. We don't know quite the timing or pace of it. Marx didn't have a, you know, time metric for this. But it was a real prediction. He wasn't just saying maybe so, maybe not. Maybe there would be some counter tendencies that could make it last indefinitely. No, he had a real prediction. Capitalism destroys the conditions of its own existence. In the aftermath of that destruction, Marx was a little more ambiguous. Sometimes he would have a clearly teleological view, and communism with socialism as a transition comes after. Other times it was more ambiguous. Human society could just collapse into barbarism, and new forms of oppression as yet unknown. So he wasn't always flatly teleological, knowing the actual outcome of that process. But about capitalism, he was. Capitalism's demise is predicted by the theory. I don't think the grounds for that argument are sound. It's not that I believe the opposite. That is, I don't think we have grounds for believing capitalism can always repair its internal damages and its internal contradictions. No, I'm not saying that either. I just think we have to pull back to a more indeterminate view of how the laws of motion and dynamics of capitalism propel a particular trajectory. There are possible futures, not any that we can give strong arguments that we know in advance which one is most likely. Okay, that's one part. The labor theory of value was a particular technology, a particular set of methodological techniques for analyzing, in quantitative terms, the properties of an economy. At the time Marx wrote, it was the standard way that everybody did it. Marx did not invent the labor theory of value. What Marx did was said, given the labor theory of value, there are some properties of it that no one else had observed. And he was right about that. If the labor theory of value is a good way of thinking about economies, Marx then discovered some implications of it which were completely unknown at the time. And he then, in an extraordinarily brilliant way, I mean, really, as an intellectual achievement, it's fantastic, drew out those implications into a very broad account of the dynamics of the capitalist political economy. But the premise was that the labor theory of value is an adequate way of understanding, in quantitative terms, the properties of a complex market economy, and capitalist economy in particular. And you know, when you read Marx, there's basically no argument in favor of it. We'll discuss this a little bit in a couple of weeks. There's one very thin argument that he makes, but it's just wrong. You know, it's an incorrect argument for the labor theory of value. And so I don't think the labor theory of value is a robust part of the core. I think it can be a useful heuristic device, a kind of pedagogical point. It's a way of giving a simple account of exploitation that has a kind of transparent meaning to it, so it's useful in that respect. But I don't think it's explanatory. It does not explain the rate of profit, which is the key thing that Marx thought it explained. It does not explain where profits come from. It gives you a description of profits in a particular metric, a labor metric of profits. And for some purposes, that could help clarify some points you want to make kind of didactically, you know, in terms of exposition. But it doesn't explain profits. It just doesn't. So some people say, well, that's the linchpin, that this technical machinery that Marx adopted in the middle of the 19th century, which was the lingua franca of political economy at the time, that if you pull out that linchpin, then the whole edifice collapses. Well, I just think that's just not true. You can have a concept of exploitation without the labor theory of value. You can have a concept of class and class domination and class structure. You can have all these other key elements. And above all, you can have the critique of capitalism and the harms it creates and a theory of alternative in which class is a central category. You can have all that without the labor theory of value. And to me, that's what really constitutes the guts of the robust core of this intellectual tradition. It's just to kind of restate it. It's the diagnosis and critique of the harms generated by capitalism, the elaboration of key aspects of alternative, what it would mean to transcend those harm-producing processes, and an account of class as being at the center of this diagnosis and critique and the specification of alternative. I don't think you have to bring a lot of other things along with it. You don't have to bring the teleological bit. You don't have to bring the labor theory of value as a particular way of talking about it. I don't think you even have to bring class struggle as the motor of history. You know, the kind of class is not just a central property of what needs transforming, and class forces are a central aspect of the transformation. You don't have to go from a central to the central. So you don't have to become a class, you don't have to argue for class primacy in order to still be within this robust theoretical set of ideas. If you said class might or might not be relevant, class could be irrelevant, then you're really outside. Class analysis is at the center of the analysis, but it doesn't mean other things aren't also at the center. Does that kind of navigate those? Okay, good. Other. I had a lovely set of interesting discussions this morning, starting at 8:30. By the way, just for those of you who might want to join us, this is open forum discussion. People wander in, just enter whatever we're talking about. So don't worry about if you come and there's already a couple of people talking, you can just join in. If you really want to get the floor, then come at closer to 8:30. We had 45 minutes with one person talking about some themes, and then a few other people joined in. Anyway, there was one issue raised which I thought would be useful to share with everybody, which was a question raised about the idea of viability of alternatives and how, and the difficulty of knowing fully in advance what will and will not be viable, and therefore the necessity of a kind of experimentalist view of this matter, which sometimes is called democratic experimentalism. You know, that's a way of capturing the character of the experimental process. It has to be participatory and democratic rather than elite, smarty pants driven from above. So democratic experimentalism is the way to think about how you actually establish viability of alternatives. And in that discussion, an analogy occurred to me. You know, so this is a case where I learned from our office hour. I learned from everything. I mean, I learned from our classes. This might sound a little weird. I learned from hearing myself say the same thing I've said for years and realizing that's a bit stale. There's got to be a better way, you know. So you learn from all of these things. So there was an analogy that popped into my head in that discussion, which I hadn't actually used before, which I do think clarified some of the discussion. And it was, the analogy was in medicine, with drug therapies for various illnesses, let's say cancer, right? So you can think of the human body as that has cancer in it as one in which the person is desperately seeking an alternative. You know, they want their identity to have continuity. They want to live, but without this harm-generating process. And through medical science and various discoveries, one way of doing that is to poison the cancer cells. We've developed various techniques to do so. So the issue of viability then can be thought of as this way. In the lab, where scientists study the processes and mechanisms, they can have really developed ideas about what kind of molecule, when inserted into a human body, will bind to a cancer cell in such a way as to destroy it and not harm the rest of the body. That's the kind of abstract characterization of chemotherapy, right? So you inject people with stuff that is alien to their bodies. It attacks those cancer cells and leaves the rest of the body sufficiently intact that the person survives. You can develop models in the lab. You try it on mice. Mice are referred to as mouse models. You can try it on mice. You do it in the lab. You've established, on the basis of all of the knowledge you have about how molecules work and how bodies work, that this is a plausible therapy. But you don't then, on that basis alone, issue this drug to doctors around the world and say, start injecting it into patients. We now know how to produce the alternative bodies you want. And the reason is there are masses of unanticipated side effects that come because of the complexities of the interactions that occur in actual bodies compared to what occurs in a lab. And it's always necessary, therefore, to go step by step. So there's a series of trials that you have to go through to establish levels of toxicity, to establish that there aren't side effects that are so bad that the cure is worse than the disease, and even that the mechanism that you thought worked because it worked in the Petri dish actually works in human bodies. Because sometimes it's not just that the toxicities are harmful, there may not be, it's just that the mechanism doesn't actually work when it's done in live bodies. That's the process of democratic experimentalism, so to speak. That's when you actually take it away from the realm of theory, and a lab, the work you do in the lab is still theory. That is, you're developing evidence which enables you to theoretically predict that it will work in people, but you don't yet know that it will. And the only way to do it is to try it and to carefully monitor it, to have a process by which you learn in the process itself about how to improve and how to change, and mostly those efforts fail. That is, most predicted viable therapies turn out to be not viable, either because they're too toxic or because they don't actually do the job that you thought they were going to do. Well, that's, I think, pretty close to the issue around transforming the complex social world that we live into an alternative that's free of the harm-generating mechanisms of capitalism. We do know a lot. I mean, I don't think we're operating from a kind of naive, pre-scientific, just with folk intuitions here. We do know a lot about some projects of transformation that don't work, about some things that are very likely to work if scaled up. The obstacles we face is as much that the equivalent of the NSF not giving any funding for clinical trials. You know, we face a big obstacle in doing these experiments because the power structures don't allow experimentation. One way of thinking about the political problem of creating the space for interstitial transformation, you know, all the stuff I talk about, one way of thinking about what the political project is to create the possibility of serious experimentation. The problem with ruptural transformation is that if that is the necessary condition for experimentation, we can't experiment with the ruptural process. That is, ruptures themselves are massive interventions into the social body, so to speak, and the unintended consequences of ruptures unleash social processes that, from what we know historically, from the best evidence available, obstruct the possibility of the kind of experimentation needed in order to create emancipatory alternatives. So we're in a box, you know, we're in this horrible situation of having tons of good ideas about what would make the world a better place. Deep, you know, really. Ideas which, if you could snap your fingers and put them in place, the world would be a better place. But we can't experiment with them because of the way the power structures narrow the horizons of innovation. That's the context in which this alternative way of thinking about it, about building alternative institutions in the spaces possible by mobilizing resources in spite of those obstacles, rather than treating the obstacles as, you know, untransgressible barriers. That's where that sort of real utopia impulse comes from. And then when there are historic moments where you can enlist broader forces to expand those spaces, you seize those opportunities. Okay, that's the result of a good conversation over mediocre coffee in the... They do have very cheap coffee there. It's not terrible. I mean, it's sort of standard mediocre coffee. It's at standard mediocre coffee standards as opposed to substandard mediocre coffee. But if you really like coffee, I would recommend picking it up at somewhere en route rather than getting it at the faculty club. All right, we should move on to today's agenda. What I want to explore today is what I call the anchor, the core anchor of the whole enterprise. If Marxism, whatever else it is, it's the diagnosis and critique of capitalism. That's the core of it. The other stuff that Marxists do, discussing feudal society and its dynamics, there's some fantastically interesting work about ancient civilizations that have been done by Marxists. All of that stuff really gets its point within the Marxist tradition by virtue of the way it helps illuminate concepts and ideas and dynamics which are relevant to the diagnosis and critique of capitalism. Because that's the world in which we're in, and that's the world we want to transform. So what I want to do is spend some time today discussing capitalism as a system. This is way more than we can do in a lecture. This lecture and the next are really a kind of paired lecture. The diagnosis of capitalism and then the central critique. So I will undoubtedly not finish this whole lecture today to give us time for discussion, but it will carry over into the next lecture, in which we will also do the central critical points. Okay. So first, you all have your outline. First, a note on concepts and definitions. So we'll be returning to this methodological issue frequently. I've already mentioned it a little bit. And I want to just spend a little bit of time talking about what concepts are and how to think about concepts. What are we actually doing when we're defining terms in a social theory? First point to make is a distinction between words and concepts. Words, the same word is often used to identify really distinct concepts. And it's important not to get hung up on this. So words are conventions, but concepts can be badly or correctly defined. A word, you know, it doesn't make sense to say this word. What's the true definition of a word? Because words evolve in our language. They have lots of meanings. Any given word has lots of meanings. We'll encounter this especially when we talk about the word class. Because the word class in the history of social thought has come to be used in ways that really identify different concepts. So it's a kind of useful term. It has a popular resonance. There's a sort of folk meaning of the word class. But in sociology and in social theory, the word just identifies very different kinds of concepts. And a lot of confusion occurs when people don't recognize that. Okay, so that's the first point, words and concepts. Second point, a tricky matter, the level of abstraction of a definition. This is, I think, a really interesting idea but pretty difficult to fully nail down. I like to use analogies. You'll see this throughout the course to kind of clarify things, because there are familiar contexts for you for which this isn't a big deal. You all understand what it means. And I think biology is a good place for this. So until a few years ago, we had a wonderful dog named Ozzy. He was a corgi. Ozzy was a specific instance of a creature that lived in our house. There are many different concepts that you could use to answer the question, what is that? If you had never seen a dog before, you recently arrived on this planet, and you saw Ozzy running around in our yard, pointed it, said, what is it? There are many correct answers. I could say, oh, this is Ozzy. He's been with us for 10 years. I could say it's a corgi. I could say it's a dog. It's a canine. It's an animal. It's a mammal. It's an animal. It's a living thing. Those are all correct answers. It's not false to say that the answer to the question, what is that? It's a mammal, is a false answer. It's a correct answer. But it may be the wrong level of abstraction depending upon why you're asking the question, right? So they differ in levels of abstraction, but which is the right level of abstraction for any given question depends upon what the point is. If you were interested in the question of whether or not Ozzy was dangerous, saying it was a mammal wouldn't be a very good answer. Saying it was a dog would be a better answer. Saying it was a corgi would get you a pretty good answer. Corgis are rarely attack people. But for is it dangerous, you probably need to know about Ozzy. You need to know that it's a house pet that was raised in a family that chastise it when it nipped, right? The level of abstraction of a concept, the appropriate level of abstraction, depends upon what the problem is you're trying to solve. So if we want to ask the question, what kind of economy do we have in the United States? Right? So one answer is it's a capitalist economy. What kind of economy do we have in Sweden? One answer is it's a capitalist economy. What kind of economy do we have in Indonesia? One answer to the question is it's a capitalist economy. Now, for some points, for some reasons why you're asking the question, that could be a pretty good answer. For others, it's a really lousy answer. It just doesn't identify what it is about that economy that will help you answer the question in question, the question in question, the, you know, answer the, what the real question you're asking is. So we will shortly discuss the problem of different levels of abstraction at which we can think of actual capitalist societies. In the case of biology, because we have such an extraordinarily powerful theory of the evolution of species, that's what gives us an ability to have nested concepts where the levels of abstraction are very well ordered. And we understand the principle by which you move from living thing to animal. I may not have all of these. There may be, you know, there's orders and there's families, whatever. You know, living things, animal, mammal, canine, dog, Ozzy, right? So you, corgi, Ozzy. So we have this nice hierarchy. And we know where that hierarchy comes from. It's the result of evolution and the splitting off of species and the creation of subspecies, etc. In sociology and in social theory, we don't have nearly such an elegant account. There's no obvious, consensual, fully defined, nested set of levels of abstraction. So it's messier. The messiness doesn't mean you shouldn't think about the level of abstraction. It just means it's not going to be neat and tidy the way it is in biology. Finally, a point about concepts and theories. Concepts only get their full meaning from the theories of which they're a part. So you've got this little problem. You need concepts in order to build theories, but the meaning of the concepts depends upon the theories within which they function. So there's a deep interconnection between the concepts that are the component building blocks of theories and the theories themselves, which in turn shape the meaning of the concepts. This is not so different from the way language in general works. The meaning of words comes from its interconnection with all other words. There are some words that whose meaning can be identified independently of connection with other words because they refer to concrete objects. But any word that has an abstract character to it, that is abstracted from the concrete instance, requires other words to explain it. And that's therefore creates the fact that you have to know a language in order to read a dictionary, but the dictionary is what tells you what the meaning of all the words are in the language. One way of thinking about this issue of concepts and theories, which is a way of helping understand how a theory gives meaning to its constituent concepts. And so that's the problem at hand. How does the theory in which a concept figure add to the meaning of the concept itself? One way of thinking about this is that what theories do, in part, is define what we can call a contrast space for a given concept. A contrast space. That's what evolutionary biology does. It tells us for the word mammal, aha, it's not a reptile. That's a contrast space, right? There's a level of abstraction at which all creatures can be distinguished from each other. And the definition of mammal is partially a differentiation from the definition of reptile. So we say warm-blooded versus cold-blooded. That's an attribute that helps us contrast all the different species at whatever level of abstraction we're talking about for that. A contrast space. Nailing down a concept then often involves really getting clear-headed about what is it being contrasted to. We'll be doing this again throughout the semester. When we get to class next week, one of the nifty things to worry about is class is one kind of social division. What is it that differentiates class as a social cleavage from other kinds of social cleavages? And really getting a sharp line of demarcation is one way of clarifying exactly what we mean by class. And it's also a trap, because sometimes things aren't as neat as, you know, reptiles and mammals. You know, you've got platypuses, right, who lay eggs. And mammals don't lay eggs, but platypuses do lay eggs. Weird. They're great, but they are pretty weird. So, you know, contrast spaces are difficult, and part of the interest is in then finding overlaps, fuzzy sets. I mean, there's all this sort of stuff. Theories are what give you the contrast space. So what's the contrast space for capitalism? What is it contrasted to? There are, I think, two kinds of contrast spaces within which this concept is located. One is that capitalism is part of a contrast space in which a mode of production is one way of classifying societies as opposed to other ways of classifying societies. So there are many ways we'll take society as our thing to be classified. There are many ways we can classify societies, and only one of them is a way of classifying in which capitalism is one of the classificatory concepts. So let me give you, actually this would be a case where I could just ask you, because some of you are sophisticated social theorists and in formation. Just let's just toss out ways of classifying societies that in which capitalism doesn't figure. Give me other ways of classifying society in which the mode of production of which capitalism is a variant isn't a relevant category from social theories that you've studied. Some of you should know the answer, should be able to give answers to this without thinking hard. If you have to think hard, then you don't quite get them, because as soon as I tell you these alternative classification systems, you'll know, oh yeah, of course.
Secular or religion? religious.
Okay, that's a good one. Right. We could classify societies as secular religious. Yeah.
Command economy.
I still didn't.
Command economy.
Yeah.
Command. Well, no, the command economy is different from capitalism, but it's part of the same classification system. So if you're classifying societies by modes of production, one type within that contrast space would be the command economy, capitalism, feudalism, slavery maybe. There's a bunch of different kinds of economic structures within which the command economy would be one. So capitalism would be contrasted to the command economy, but they're within the same classification system. So I'm asking for other classification systems for societies. Yeah. Well, since we don't observe any degendered society, not gendered societies, I don't think any, we could describe societies as matrilineal, patrilineal, matriarchal, patriarchal. So we could have a classification system of societies by their forms of gender relations. But not gendered versus non-gendered.
Less gendered.
Yeah. Well, not even less or more. It's more on the qualitative forms in which they occur. One could also add to that gender classification, which would be a very recent development, the degree of genderedness of an economy, of a social structure. Yeah?
A different culture, like, you know, Oriental culture,
right.
Society, or even Christian society.
Right, right. So Christian, Confucian, Judeo-Christian, Islamic, Hindu, you know, there's the different big cultures, there's civilizational classifications, Western versus Eastern, you know, some of these are very crude, some of them are fairly nuanced, but it's basically a typology of forms of society on the basis of their cultural complexes, you know, the kind of complex clustering of cultural elements. In sociology, another one that's very conventional is traditional versus modern. There's a whole, it's not so popular anymore, but in the 1950s there was something called modernization theory, which had as its master classification of all societies where they fell on a continuum from traditional to modern. And that way of thinking about classification still, there's at least a shadow of it in the concept of postmodern. So the expression postmodern and postmodernity only gets its meaning by virtue of a contrast with modernity, which got its meaning from a contrast to traditional. So postmodern views of the we're in a postmodern world are embedded in a classification system, which implies a theory within which those classifications make sense. Often postmodern theorists ignore that theoretical tradition. They don't talk about postmodern versus traditional. It's a different kind of theoretical move they've done, but still I think it's embedded in that kind of train. In sociology, probably the most common implicit what kind of society do we live in is based just on their technologies. You've heard these sort of things, hunting, gathering, agrarian, industrial, post-industrial, the knowledge society. This is a classification system. It's basically a classification system based on the dominant technology. That's a component of a mode of production analysis, but it's different. And indeed, this is a standard, for those of you who are sociology grad students, this is a standard prelim question. What's the difference between a mode of production typology, it wouldn't be asked this way, but a mode of production classification system of societies and a technological classification system? Okay, so that's the first bit of the contrast space. Capitalism is located in a particular kind of contrast space, one that is built around the nature of its economic structure. The term for economic structure that's used at the most abstract level in the Marxist tradition is mode of production. But really, you should think of mode of production as an abstract way of describing the economic structure of a society. It's not a concrete way of describing an economic structure because no economic structure ever could be only capitalist. So an actual economic structure always has more needs more description, more elements of classification than just capitalist, if you're being very concrete, if you're getting down to the nitty-gritty of what's happening on the ground. It's a more abstract, but powerful abstract way of describing contrasting societies on the basis of the economic structures they have. And mode of production is the term that's used to denote that. Here are the contrasts, the sort of the conventional contrast that certainly that Marx used was primitive communism, feudalism, sometimes slavery would be added as a distinct mode of production, sometimes a concept that is pretty awkward in the Marxist tradition, the Asiatic mode of production is used as another type of mode of production. It has been relabeled. That was a term, I think, that Marx used at one point, Asiatic mode of production. It got relabeled as the tributary mode of production in some writings, but it's an awkward component. It's a part of this classification system within the mode of production way of building a contrast space that doesn't fit comfortably. Primitive communism and feudalism fit very comfortably. Slavery fits pretty comfortably. And capitalism. And then two modes of production, which are predictions about the future. Socialism and communism. Sometimes socialism is simply viewed as the early stages of the development of communism. So socialism is to communism as mercantile capitalism is to fully developed capitalism. That is, capitalism had some early forms before it became full bore, the capitalism which we've grown to love and hate. Sometimes socialism is viewed as simply the lower stage of communism. Other times it's treated more as if it's a distinct type of economic structure, which would then evolve into to something else. Well, that's a typology. It's a set of distinctions. Each of these modes of production requires definition and debate, and it turns out it's not so easy to define all of these distinctions. There's many different and contending definitions of feudalism, for example. And I would say there is nothing that could be described as a universally accepted core definition of how pre-capitalist modes of production should be defined abstractly. But there's a family of interconnected definitions. All right, that's the contrast space. Now let's get to the definition. What are we talking about when we talk about capitalism? This is point three. There are two, I think, so just to warn you, throughout this course, I like to do things like say, there are three of X, there are two of this. You know, I'd like to list things, number them, make distinctions. That's a hazardous occupation, you know, style of work, because it always, whenever I say there's two, there's undoubtedly a third that I'm not talking about. Or there are cases which are overlapping and are mixed, or there are approaches which are just confused and don't neatly fall into either of these. So you should always, I've given a lot of thought to this when I say there are two main approaches to defining capitalism. I think it's accurate, that is, broadly speaking, different approaches to defining different definitions can be subsumed under these two, but you should not take any expository claim like that I make as somehow a definitive assertion of how best to think about these things. This is just a way of organizing our discussion. Okay, two broad ways. One way defines capitalism as a distinct form of market society, and another way defines capitalism as a distinct organization of production, in which markets are an element, but which the market aspect is not the central defining property. So first, let's just briefly talk about the market way of defining capitalism. This is usually done by drawing itself a contrast between two kinds of market societies. So the way to give the specificity to capitalism as a type of market society is to draw another contrast. Contrasts are the way you get specificity to any given concept. And here the contrast is between what's called simple commodity production and capitalist commodity production. The word commodity. This is the word commodity in everyday language now in contemporary American society. You think about the commodity market in Chicago for pork bellies. Pork bellies are the, for whatever reason, that's the classic thing that people talk about. The people have futures contracts in pork bellies. When the word commodity is used in that sense, it refers to kind of primary products. Either extractive or agricultural, sometimes other things. They're standardized products so that you can measure them typically in terms of bushels or pounds. So coal is a commodity. You can buy and sell tons of it. So commodities in the contemporary everyday language use refers to a particular kind of product that's sold on markets. In the Marxian terminology, commodity refers to anything that is produced for sale on a market. It's just, that's what it is. It's not complicated. If you produce a hamburger for your family to eat, it's not a commodity. It's just a hamburger for your family to eat. If you produce a hamburger to sell at McDonald's, it's a commodity. Producing something for the purpose of exchange, the thing in question is a commodity, whether it be a good or a service. But goods are a little simpler for various reasons. So the classic way that Marxists describe a market process that is a simple commodity process is that people produce a given commodity, corn. They sell it on a market and receive money, and they use that money to buy clothing, let's say. That is, they don't produce clothing, they produce corn, but they need clothing, so they produce the corn, sell it on the market, and buy clothing. You begin with a bundle of commodities, and at the end of the process, you end with a bundle of commodities. That's simple commodity exchange. In the absence of money, if you produce corn, you have to find somebody who produces clothing who wants your corn, and you then exchange directly corn for clothing. Well, you can see why if some people produce clothing and some people produce corn, it's a pretty cumbersome way to get your clothing if you have to find the person who happens to want corn. And that's why money was this incredibly useful invention, and forms of money have occurred virtually in every society that is beyond hunting and gathering. That is, in any society where there's any kind of production of by one group of people in order to acquire other things, to have an intermediary token that embodies the value of what you've produced, however crudely, facilitates that exchange tremendously. Money may be the root of all evil, but it's an absolutely essential way of organizing simple, even very simple exchange. Well, that's simple commodity production. And it's referred to, the symbolic way of representing this is CMC. That's the way Marx developed it, and that's still used in the Marxist tradition. Capitalist commodity production, from a market perspective, has a different logic. You begin with a bundle of money, call it capital. You use that to buy a bunch of commodities of different sorts, means of production, raw material inputs, and crucially, labor. Now, in slave societies, you actually buy people. You buy laborers. In capitalist society, you don't do that. What you do is you buy the use of the labor of workers, and you pay what you pay the worker is what that worker needs in order to reproduce their own labor. That is, you're paying them the value of their own ability to labor. That's called the value of their labor power. That's what the wage is. The wage enables workers to buy the food, clothing, and other things they need in order to show up to work the next day. So you're paying for the worker, the value of what it takes that worker to work. You buy all these commodities, means of production, inputs, labor, put them together in a production process, and they, what do they generate? They generate commodities. This whole process generates commodities, which you then sell on the market for more money. And the remarkable thing about capitalism is you start with a bundle of money, convert it into commodities, you sell all of those for money, and you end up with more money than you started with. That's why it's MCM prime. That prime just means it's different from where you started. That difference between the initial money and the subsequent money is profits. And because the idea in the Marxian tradition is that these terms all represent a certain amount of value, that's called surplus value. It's value above the value you started with. It's extra value that's been added. There's value added to the production process, which is represented by that larger sum of money. That's the market logic of defining capitalism. Capitalism is a system in which the market is organized around that sequence, MCM prime, rather than CMC. I prefer, as a way of thinking about the definition of capitalism, a definition which centers around its structural properties, how the economic organization is structured, rather than simply this market logic. And in those terms, I think capitalism is defined by two key structural properties: by its class relations, and by its structure of economic coordination. These two elements, the class relations in which production is organized and the coordination mechanisms across units of production. Class relations will be the subject of the next block of the course. We'll be spending a lot of time discussing it. It's basically the social relations in which means of production are owned and deployed within the production process, and power and its own and power over the use of those means of production occurs. Class relations are social relations through which means of production are owned and power is exercised over their use. Well, I'm not going to belabor this here because we're going to look at a very fine-grained way of how to unpack that idea. But in capitalism, this means that the means of production are privately owned and the use of those means of production are controlled by those owners or their surrogates. But the means of production, of course, do not themselves do anything. Means of production are inert. They don't produce anything unless they're set in motion. And that means you have to somehow or other get human laboring activity involved in the use of those means of production. Now, in the simplest contexts of production, the owner can him or herself be the labor power. And that's a kind of residual category where the employer, the owner of the means of production, employs their own labor power, so to speak. And sometimes Marxists like to talk about that as a situation in which workers exploit themselves because they're also owners. I myself think of that as not properly fully capitalism, that capitalism requires the deployment of labor other than the labor of the owner and controller of the means of production. But again, these are issues that have ambiguities to them, and there are arguments for why one might still want to call that just the limiting case of capitalism. But the normal fully developed, non-limiting case of capitalism is one in which the owners quickly see an advantage to getting other people to actually set the means of production into motion. And above all, that makes it possible to set way more means of production into motion than would ever be possible if the only labor that would be used within production was the labor of owners. If you want to maximize how much you can produce and how much you can convert M into M prime, if you want to really ratchet that up, the way you do it is by mobilizing the labor of others to use your means of production rather than just mobilizing your own labor to do so. And that's really what sets in motion the capitalist class structure and all the surrounding difficulties it forms. So you've got to get people to be willing to set your means of production into motion. Well, one way to do that is to be sure they don't have much alternative. If everybody has a good alternative where they could set their own means of production into motion, it's tough to recruit a labor force. So one thing you got to do is destroy the possibility of other people being able to survive without working for you. Well, that's been a classic thing that's happened in capitalism. It's called primitive accumulation. That is where the central problem capitalists face is how to dispossess people of their own means of production. In order to create the necessary labor force, in order to set in motion your means of production. That's the class relations. The economic coordination is through markets, which I've already just briefly described. Capitalism, then, is a particular class structure coordinated through a particular kind of coordination mechanism, markets. Let me just mention complexity, and then we will break, and on Thursday I'll talk about the dynamics issue and then the critique. First, complexity. So this is a very abstract definition, right? There's only two classes, capitalists and workers. And there's only one coordination mechanism, markets. For some purposes, that's fine. You know, there's some questions you will want to ask when you're studying things empirically for which that's the concept that's appropriate. But for a whole lot of questions, that's a pretty feeble set of categories. It just doesn't do the job. And therefore, we need ways of thinking about less abstractly about economic structures. Actual capitalist societies are way more complex. So one way of thinking about what it means to move to lower levels of abstraction is adding complexity. You have all the properties of the higher level of abstraction plus. So when you go from mammal to dog, dogs have all the properties that all mammals have plus some properties that that other mammals don't have. So you're adding complexity. Moving to concrete levels of abstraction always implies adding complexity. When people argue that an analysis is oversimplified, that can either mean it's just a stupid analysis, that is that the abstract concepts used aren't even the right abstract concepts to use. That's one argument. But properly, oversimplification just means it's too abstract for the problem. That's the right way to use that expression. Oversimplified means you've ratcheted up the level of abstraction too much for the problem at hand. Overcomplexified means you've gone down to too low a level of abstraction. You've added too much booming, buzzing complexity. You don't see the forest for the trees. Actually, the problem you're trying to study should be stated at a more abstract level. How do we add complexity? Well, there's a lot of ways. One way to add complexity is that any actual society, any actual economy is always involves some kind of complicated mixture of capitalist and non-capitalist forms of economic organization. And to analyze in a complexly rich way an economic structure is precisely to understand how all these different forms of combination fit together or don't fit together. It doesn't have to be harmonious. It can be in tension with each other. In capitalist economies, there's one particular combination which is absolutely pervasive, which no capitalist society has functioned without. And that's the relationship between what we can call domestic production, the way people within families produce goods and services to meet needs, and capitalist market production. Domestic production is not coordinated by markets. I mean, you have some perverse families which might have an internal market, you know, where everybody gets paid for their contribution, but it's pretty perverse, and of course that's not what really happens. The internal economy of households is organized on bases of communal reciprocity and strong norms of mutual support, producing to meet needs, governed often by the communist aphorism, to each according to need, from each according to ability. certainly that's the kind of the idealized way in which a healthy family with respect and reciprocities would organize all of the productive activities needed for the domestic economy of a household, which includes cooking dinners and fixing, you know, household repairs and taking care of children. Childcare is a productive activity, and how you organize it. So all capitalist societies involve an articulation between domestic production and capitalist production. And they don't always work together very well. The strength of domestic production has at times been an obstacle to capital accumulation because it restricts the labor supply for capitalism. The post-World War II period is a saga in part of the destruction of aspects of the domestic economy in order to tap into a huge unused labor supply, namely educated, particularly educated women. You know, so the changes in the economic structure in the post-war period required literate labor. What was the biggest source of literate labor that wasn't heavily involved in the labor market in 1955? Educated women. By educated, I mean literate. I don't mean, you know, PhDs. I just mean people who were literate and numerate, who could become secretaries, basically, and enter the service economy. Okay. Capitalism is always mixed with non-capitalist forms. But in addition to that, there's all sorts of different kinds of capitalism. You know, capitalism may be like mammals, but there are horses and there are dogs and there are lions. You know, there's all sorts of different kinds of capitalism. And a lot of the theoretical debate and development of economic sociology, more so than economics, because sociology is much more concerned with institutional variation, a lot of it is directed precisely at trying to understand the forms of variation of capitalism itself. There's the degree of competitiveness, the degree of centralization and concentration of capital, how globalized or nationally contained. So what's the relationship between the economic arena of action of capital and the regulatory arena of states? Globalization is a story about the disarticulation between states and capital, because capitalism operates on a different scale from states. The industrial and sectoral varieties. You can have agrarian capitalism, industrial capitalism, post-industrial capitalism. The degree of financialization. How important are credit markets and capital markets in generating the overall rhythms of an economy? Does industry dominate finance, or does finance dominate industry? These are variable forms of capitalism, all of which are equally capitalist, but which vary in the way in which certain kinds of powers are distributed. And that's the way those are all at lower levels of abstraction than the definition of capitalism as a mode of production. Okay, that's a little more than halfway through. Let's take a break now. Come back at 20 after, and then we'll have 40 minutes to discuss these definitional issues around capitalism. And then on Thursday, we'll talk about the dynamics of capitalism and the critique of capitalism. Okay, take a break.